From Elizabethtown to Connellsville, Erie to Camp Hill, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Pennsylvania will continue to have divided government at the state level, but there are still some policies that both Democrats and Republicans can agree upon. David Taylor is joined by Stephen Bloom for a look at the upcoming legislative session. And heavily gerrymandered state legislative maps have once again produced a standoff in the state House of Representatives. I'll have a town hall commentary on the impact. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capitol Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Pennsylvania State Senate President Pro Tempore Kim Ward of Westmoreland County is calling on Governor Josh Shapiro to take a firm stand on the proposed acquisition of U.S. Steel by Nippon Steel. In a letter to the governor, Ward outlined the negative effects on the Pittsburgh region were the deal to fail. Currently, a federal agency is reviewing the potential impact of the deal on national security. Ward said in her letter that Shapiro's support of the Nippon deal is urgently needed to ensure the continued presence of U.S. Steel and its facilities in southwestern Pennsylvania. The only response from the governor's office is that he plans to be a, quote, honest broker in the process. A failure of the deal to be completed could result in the loss of manufacturing facilities and thousands of jobs. In a few days, we will know the final outcome of the close U.S. Senate race in Pennsylvania. Republican challenger Dave McCormick had a narrow lead over incumbent U.S. Senator Robert P. Casey Jr. at the conclusion of the official count. However, since McCormick's margin of victory fell under 0.5%, an automatic recount was triggered. That recount will be completed early this week, and results should be known by Thanksgiving. In the meantime, all major news organizations have called the race for McCormick, who will join a 53-47 Republican majority in the U.S. Senate. Dr. Mehmet Oz, the famed television doctor and renowned cardiothoracic surgeon who lost the 2022 U.S. Senate race in Pennsylvania to U.S. Senator John Fetterman, has been appointed by President-elect Donald Trump to head the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. You may recall Oz narrowly edged out David McCormick for the Republican U.S. Senate nomination in 2022 before going on to lose the general election to Fetterman. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. The recent general election resulted in no change in the partisan makeup of the state legislature. The GOP continues to be a majority in the Senate. Democrats hold a one-seat majority in the House. But with that divide, what sort of policies might we see enacted over the next 2 years? David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation for a Capitol Watch discussion. David?
And welcome once again to Capitol Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, my main man, Steve Bloom, Vice President of the Commonwealth Foundation. So we all survived the election. Last time around, we were talking with the listeners about, again, how things settled out. But now the work begins. Even though the new legislative session won't actually convene until January, that the lawmakers will assume office 1st of December. And so, you know, the work begins as to exactly what kind of business that the lawmakers are going to conduct for the people in the next 2 years.
When you look at the structure of after the tumult of the election, mm-hmm. that we've all been through here for the last, well, months and months of advertising and then an actual beginning of early voting and ultimately an election that's pretty much over, although there's still one or two races outstanding out there. But all that being done, in Pennsylvania, oddly enough, the structure of our legislature remains almost identical to what it was going into the election.
Yeah.
So we have a state Senate that is a 28-22 Republican majority.
Mm-hmm.
We have a state House that is divided. It is 102-101, and the Democrats have that 102nd vote again. And so between those two chambers and the governor, who's a Democrat, We have divided government. We have a divided legislature. We have all the complexities that make it very hard for either side in the political debate to get things done. It's going to be challenging for him. It's going to be challenging, though, for all of us who care about public policy in our Commonwealth, because there are good initiatives, certainly, that the voters, especially in light of the results of the nationwide and statewide elections, things that the citizenry want to have happen that may not be able to happen because of the divided nature of our government. How do we still actually get good things done over these next 2 years until the next statewide election cycle?
Right. And so this was something that the governor said, Governor Shapiro said in his first inaugural address, that because of these conditions, the alignment of the political forces, that to use a football metaphor, that this is a game that's going to have to be played between the 40-yard lines. I hope that the policy priorities match up with that particular sentiment. Sometimes it hasn't really seemed as though they have, but again, the larger point here is, if we're going to have good policy enacted, it's going to need to be consensus-based. It's going to need to be common sense-based to say, what are the things that we know that the public needs? What are the urgent concerns that we have before us? And how do we address those urgent concerns?
And at the Commonwealth Foundation, we do statewide policy. We advocate for good policy from a free market economic principle that will help empower all Pennsylvanians to flourish. Like that's what we do. And we've been at this for a long time. And one of the things we do when we get an unfavorable or at least a neutral reaction to a new election where neither side has real leverage, we've thought long and hard about what can we do to still make a difference in that environment and still advance good public policy in that kind of environment.
Yes.
Not trying to pretend it doesn't exist, not trying to pretend it's not challenging.
Right.
But there are things we can do. And so we've set about to figure out, okay, what can we do given where the chips fell to maximize the value here for getting some important new policies enacted and protecting against bad policies under this divided government that Pennsylvania has. And so we've been working on a document. We call it Empowering Pennsylvanians. And it's a statement of transformative solutions for things that Pennsylvania voters care about and was manifest in the results of the election and could actually be done.
Mm-hmm.
Things that Governor Shapiro has sometimes even talked about in a very favorable manner, or other times at least alluded to potentially supporting.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not unrealistic from the governor's perspective, and things that could ultimately get enacted as part of a compromise agreement on a state budget in June that would include some policy votes as well, some potential enactment of policies. So we drew up a list of six key things.
All right.
Key areas, really, where we could, in fact, advance good quality public policy legislation.
Let's roll it out. What do you got?
So the first thing, and these are not in order of importance, but the first thing I'll talk about is unleashing Pennsylvania energy. We have seen in every exit poll they talked about after the elections and so forth and so on, there's been a terribly strong concern among citizens for the condition of their pocketbooks, their wallets.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a hard time for folks. And with inflation that was so strong for several years and is still kicking around out there, of course, the prices never go back down once they're up.
Correct.
So they are where they are. People are really struggling, and they have been. And one of the areas we've seen dramatic price increases and a real demand on consumer is in energy, whether that be electricity created by whatever source of power that might be, whether nuclear, coal, hydro, natural gas, you know, all the solar. But the fact that energy has become such a big expense for folks, and they're wrestling with that. And so we know that from every standpoint, geopolitically, politically, in people's kitchen tables, that energy prices and the availability of reliable energy are key issues.
Yes.
And we can do some things there to get ourselves in Pennsylvania. We are already one of the top states in energy production. There's no reason we can't be at this level forever. The first step we're urging is that the legislative body and the governor take action to get Pennsylvania out of REGI, the multi-state compact
Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. It's a carbon tax.
And it basically imposed a carbon tax is what I want to get to exactly. That's the first step. We've got to take that on, get the table clean of REGI and move on with our energy policy in a way that can be...
Don't threaten the producers if you want them to produce more.
Exactly. Don't chase them out of the state with hostile regulations and even criminal prosecutions for simple administrative issues where we've seen gas companies, oil companies being bullied essentially by state authorities.
Yeah, that was by our attorney general at the time. But yes, so having a pro-production agenda for Pennsylvania Energy, Pennsylvania's natural gas reserves in the Marcellus shale play are untold trillions. And so even as Pennsylvania is already the number two producer of natural gas in America, there's so much more that we could be doing, not just in terms of increasing production, but also with building out the infrastructure to be able to deliver that energy from where it's harvested to the downstream customers who can benefit from it. And just, again, talking about manufacturing as a priority, because it's the sector that adds the most value, has the best paying jobs in the marketplace, has the strongest multiplier effect on job creation. Manufacturers need energy. We need a lot of it, and we need it to be abundant and available and market priced. So if we could have a pro-production agenda, if we could build out infrastructure to deliver it, that this would supercharge our economy by helping our manufacturers, lowering the price of creating goods. And of course, you know, you think about inflation, and it's the same as it was back in the 1970s when fuel prices went high. It pancakes through the whole economy because every step of production requires energy. And when energy is more expensive, every single step gets more expensive, and the cumulative effect is much higher prices. This is how we attack that and drive that cost down.
And Pennsylvania has, just if you look at natural gas alone, the proven reserves of natural gas in our state, we're talking hundreds of years of being able to sustain not only Pennsylvania, but be one of the top exporters in the country of either gas itself or gas-generated electricity.
Yeah.
And so this is serious business, and this is an opportunity. It's not a partisan issue. It's one that could be resolved in a way that sets us up for success going forward. Another arena that we feel like there could be progress made, and it's, again, extremely crucial to the people of Pennsylvania, is the expansion of educational opportunity for parents and students. Essentially, making sure that every Pennsylvania citizen who has a child or every child who needs an education has the ability to get a quality education no matter where they live in Pennsylvania, no matter what zip code they happen to be in.
And this is important. This is necessary because, sad to say, that there are too many schools in Pennsylvania where the performance of the students is just exceptionally poor. That these schools, I mean, you can only call them failure factories, and that it's simply unacceptable for a parent or guardian to have a student basically imprisoned in a school district based on zip code, because if you as the family don't have the money to buy the way out to go to a private school or other educational option, your kid's stuck, and that's just not right.
And these are not opinions. We're not pretending that there are some of these chronically failing schools. It's a reality. The Department of Education itself tracks the numbers. They have requirements for those schools that are in the worst performing 15%. To notify parents of other options they might have and so forth. This research is done every day in the field. We know which schools are failing, and we know that kids that are trapped there have a future that is very, very bleak, especially as compared to their peers who happen to live in a higher quality school or school district area. So this is an issue we can address. We can address this with a divided state legislature and with a Democrat or Republican governor.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from Pennsylvania Manufacturers, talking here with Steve Bloom from the Commonwealth Foundation. And just to finish that thought about these lifeline scholarships to give a way out for students who are stuck in the worst performing schools in Pennsylvania, this is something that Governor Shapiro, when he was a candidate for governor, said that he would be willing to support.
And he even spoke very positively about it in public media. For the two budget cycles he's been through already, two Pennsylvania budget cycles, and each time he's spoken highly of the concept. So this is one that certainly the leaders of the legislative chambers would like to see potentially go back to the governor's desk. And we know there's an outcry from constituents for that kind of help, because no one wants to send their children to a failing school.
So let's work through what's the next sort of priority that you folks have identified?
Our next big arena for what we can be getting done during this divided session is promoting work. And in particular, with respect to the federal programs, Medicaid and public assistance, public welfare, we have opportunities, especially given the potential for change in Washington, D.C. with regard to waivers and so forth after the election, to do some things that are common sense solutions to help people get off of those programs so they're not stuck on a public welfare program, which statistically ends up hindering their overall economic success in life. And so simple things like work and job training expectations for welfare benefits programs. It's been done in multiple states. It's worked very well where it's been done. For whatever reason, the folks in Washington have been hostile to it, but we're seeing, again, with the change coming forth here after the election, there's a decent chance that the authorities in charge of these particular things is going to be in a position to grant waivers.
And if I could just speak to that for a moment, Steve, this is important because, of course, the critics will say you're a mean person and that people need to be able to, you know, stay home and care for an elderly parent or for children or whatever. We're not talking about that. We're talking about able-bodied people without dependents, and that this requirement to either be working, to seek work, to be undergoing some kind of training to be able to take up a skill, even just to be volunteering, spending time with a public service organization or some such. This is really important for that person who's receiving the benefits, because the human spirit requires work, requires a sense of purposefulness. Like, human beings were never meant to be kept like pets or zoo animals. Like, human beings have innate dignity and ability and potential, and that the longer people like stagnate in place, the more their skill set degrades. That's why even just doing something like being a volunteer with a social service organization or like volunteer at the pet shelter, just something that gets you up and moving and applying your talents, like, that's a credential that you can use on your next job application, rather than saying, well, you know, I just sat on my butt for 6 months. And again, just like in physics, that bodies at rest tend to stay at rest. And so this isn't done to punish anyone or to be unkind to anyone. This is the tough love that people actually need, especially people who have gotten used to being in that situation.
And we're not saying that people with illnesses or disabilities or even
not
demanding family situations are expected to go out and find a job.
Right.
But those that can
should.
Absolutely should. And
yes,
it's for their own benefit. It's study after study has shown that they do better. They thrive as compared to those who end up stuck on the federal programs.
Yeah. What else you got?
Keeping Pennsylvania's economy open for business, or really making Pennsylvania's economy open for business, is another large area of opportunity for the citizens of this Commonwealth to improve our lot, to make mm-hmm. things better for ourselves and our kids. We are stifling the industries that try to invest in Pennsylvania, not only through the things we talked about, the hostility sometimes from some of the authorities, but just with an overwhelmingly heavy blanket of regulations, things that are not keeping anybody safer than they were otherwise, not things that are somehow controversial. They're just obvious situations.
Scratch your right earlobe with your left elbow.
Government has gotten too big, too powerful, and has put arbitrary restrictions and regulations across the board on those who are trying to invest in our state and grow industry here.
And Governor Shapiro has spoken to this and has really celebrated the accomplishments of his administration and the things that they have done through executive action to improve the responsiveness of state agencies, to get rid of backlogs, to improve the speed of delivery of permits and answering requests. And so, and that's good as far as it goes. What we're talking about here is making it permanent by being more systematic about it and actually putting it into law so that these kinds of reforms and improvements will remain intact between administrations.
We make our own situation worse by not taking action to reduce this burden of regulations on all of us trying to do something positive here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Another area we can look for possibilities of getting some important things finished, despite the divided government, is tax relief for businesses and households who have been just slammed by inflation and the expenses we talked about earlier.
Right.
We have an opportunity to reduce the personal income tax, for example, to reduce the corporate net income tax.
Yes.
And we started the process with the corporate net income tax. But this could be done on a broader scale and make Pennsylvania healthier and give a break to the consumers that are struggling to pay their bills.
Absolutely. And every time that we engage in this conversation, it's important to say tax rates and tax collections are two different things that actually we can improve the strength of our economy and get to a point where we are increasing receipts, where we are increasing intake to the Treasury from the private economy by helping the economy to grow. If the burdens are too high, you suffocate growth that reduces economic activity and thereby reduces tax collections. So this kind of pro-growth tax change is really, it's a separate issue. Rates are separate from collections. And yes, while there will be a dip initially in collections from reducing rates, it can get the overall economy into a better place, get us positioned for long-term growth, which will then, with a healthy economy, it'll get us into the virtuous cycle of strong economic growth, delivering greater receipts to pay for important public purposes.
Exactly. And so there's opportunity here for things to improve. And we can get some things done that we would all be proud of in this next 2 years.
So anyway, we are very hopeful that wiser heads will prevail and that obviously for those of us who are concerned about these issues, that we're going to continue to advocate for these kinds of common sense solutions. So, well, Steve, thank you for sharing all that. And, you know, sadly, we're down to the last of our time here. Before we go, could you please give the listeners info? Where can they find out more about you and Commonwealth Foundation and the work that you do?
They can visit commonwealthfoundation.org on the internet.
Outstanding. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org. And from Steve and me, thanks so much for listening. And we will catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. With apologies to Charles Dickens, it was the best of gerrymanders, it was the worst of gerrymanders. In the wake of the 2020 census, Pennsylvania undertook the constitutionally mandated redrawing of both congressional and state legislative district lines. The processes were different, but each yielded the same result. Maps blatantly drawn to advantage Democrats. The new maps were a clear gerrymander, a process named after the 19th century Massachusetts governor, Elbridge Gerry, who drew a congressional district in what appeared to be the shape of a salamander, thus giving name to the tactic. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court, in a clearly unconstitutional move, hijacked the congressional redistricting process, taking control from the legislature and turning the map drawing over to a left-wing California university professor. Pennsylvania's population had grown more slowly than had population in other states, so the Commonwealth lost one congressional district, resulting in the elimination of a Republican seat in central Pennsylvania. The remaining districts were drawn to advantage Democrats, and in 2022, the gambit worked. Democrats held on to their 9 seats, while Republicans were reduced to 8 seats. Only 3 districts were competitive in 2022, and Democrats held on to all 3. Again this year, those same 3 seats, one west of Pittsburgh, one in the Lehigh Valley, and one in northeastern Pennsylvania, were hotly contested. Added into the mix was the South Central Pennsylvania seat of Congressman Scott Perry, who was targeted by Democrats after having served as chairman of the conservative House Freedom Caucus. Perry survived the challenge, but Democrats lost the Lehigh Valley seat and the northeastern Pennsylvania seats to Republican challengers, reducing Democrats to 7 seats with 10 districts now in the GOP column. Both the congressional and legislative gerrymanders were supported by Democrat front groups like the deceptively named Fair Districts PA, which claimed their efforts were aimed at undoing past gerrymanders. They pointed to the statewide voter registration numbers, in which Democrats at the time held a significant lead, but yet failed to gain majority control in the state legislature. However, the fact Democrats are heavily concentrated in urban areas resulted in lopsided registration numbers in those districts, while Republicans were more spread out, controlling more districts but by smaller margins. Meanwhile, the legislative redistricting process was also hijacked by the Democrat gerrymander machine, with Democrat Governor Josh Shapiro empowered to appoint the fifth and deciding vote on the redistricting commission. He too turned to an academic who produced the most gerrymandered map in Pennsylvania's legislative history. The result in 2022 was that the GOP lost control of the state House of Representatives by a single seat, contributing to the legislative gridlock that has gripped Penns Woods for the past 2 years. State Senate Republicans were more adept at negotiating the Senate district map and were able to preserve a 28-22 majority. Unlike the congressional gerrymander, the legislative gerrymander this year worked like a charm. In the Senate, just two seats flipped party control. A Dauphin County or Harrisburg area seat flipped from Republican to Democrat. The gerrymander, coupled with poor candidate selection by Republicans, produced the Democrat victory. Unexpectedly, however, the GOP flipped a North Philadelphia seat to preserve its 28-22 majority. Competitive seats in Allegheny and Erie counties remained under their respective party control. The power of the gerrymander was strongest in state legislative races. Recall, Democrats have had a one-seat advantage for the past 2 years. After the expenditure of hundreds of millions of dollars by both political parties, not a single one of the 203 state House seats flipped party control. This while Donald Trump and the entire statewide Republican slate sailed to victory. Contributing to the narrow Democrat majority in the state House has been the ineffectiveness of House Republicans, both on the campaign and legislative fronts. While Senate Republicans negotiated a somewhat reasonable redistricted map, House negotiators failed completely. And as House Democrats passed a never-ending stream of ultra-left-wing messaging bills these past 2 years, House Republican leaders failed to capitalize on their extremism. Part of the problem is many stellar Republican House members have moved on to the state Senate, which enjoys strong and effective leadership. The House has been hollowed out to the point of being unable to capitalize on the strong performance of the statewide ticket. House Republican leader Brian Cutler stepped down from his post following the election. It remains to be seen whether or not the new leadership will be any more effective. What is clear is that the epic legislative gerrymander that followed the 2020 census has had its effect. Unfortunately, the GOP has missed a golden opportunity to recapture the majority. With a town hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 29 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WBXQ-FM and WKMC-AM in Altoona, along with WBFD-AM in Bedford, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.